The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anushka Astana. After a week of conference that even senior Tories dubbed a psychodrama, the Prime Minister has given what some said had to be the speech of her life. But her talk of the British dream turned into a nightmare as her speech was disrupted by a comedian brandishing a P45, a set malfunction, and an awful dose of conference cough.
Sounds as if my voice isn't on track.
We'll be hearing from our political panel here in Manchester and from Education Secretary Justine Greening.
We've got to set out our agenda for young people.
We'll also hear from MPs and members.
There's been a lot of fluff and flunder around.
Plus, we hear from UKIP members who have just selected their new leader at a lively conference in Torquay.
We've got to ensure that we do actually leave the EU because that's what people voted for.
But first, Theresa May ended this year's Tory conference with a call to renew what she called the British dream.
With a rich, ambitious agenda to follow, a bold, exciting mission to pursue, let us fulfil our duty to the British people. Let us fulfil our duty to our country. Let us fulfil our duty to Britain. And let us renew the British dream. Thank you.
But before that, a confused Prime Minister accepted a P45 form from a prankster who said Boris had told him to give it to her.
I was about to talk about somebody I'd like to give a P45 to, and that's Jeremy Corbyn.
I'm joined now by The Guardian's deputy political editor, Rowena Mason. Rowena, is it going to be fully remembered for the interruptions?
I think, unfortunately for Theresa May, yes, this will be known as the year when Theresa May had a protester interrupting her with a P45 and this terrible hacking cough that went on for most of the second half. That is really going to overshadow what she was trying to achieve in the speech, which was a series of sort of modest policy announcements, such as a new energy cap and more council housing. More widely, I think she was trying to portray herself as a Prime Minister who's still up for the fight after that election result that was disastrous for her on June the 8th.
And afterwards, people from Downing Street telling journalists that she was happy with the speech, that they clapped her into the back room. Do you think they were really happy with it?
I don't think they were. I think that's the public brave face that they're putting on it. But I did speak to some people who are just think that the whole speech was really unfortunate. It was just the convergence of these two interruptions, and then there was a sort of third final blow, which was some lettering falling off the backdrop, which just cemented an impression of chaos, really.
So accepting a P45 from a comedian about whom there'll now be an investigation, a hacking cough that required getting a cough sweep from the Chancellor, and as you say, a stage malfunction. But what was she actually trying to get across? What was this speech all about? I mean, it was very personal, wasn't it?
Yes, the speech was really aimed at being all about her personal mission. She had a phrase that was something like, "That's what drives me." And she was talking about tackling burning injustices such as racial disparities and a review of the Mental Health Act. So it was all about her wanting to achieve things in a domestic policy agenda, moving perhaps a little bit away from Brexit. There was only quite a short passage on leaving the EU in the speech. It was about 10 paragraphs. She wanted to refocus people's minds on kind of core bread and butter issues such as education, housing, and try and tell them that she was up for the fight, that she wants to carry on being Prime Minister after a couple of weeks that have been overshadowed by speculation about her leadership because of these interventions by Boris Johnson trying to undermine her.
And in particular, she talked about the idea of building more council homes. She talked about an energy price cap. I mean, they were in her manifesto, but some people might say they are dancing to Labour's tune, and even might say it sounds rather like Ed Miliband.
There were definitely tones of Ed Miliband shot through the whole speech, in particular her language about a British dream. That's a phrase that Ed Miliband's used before when talking about home ownership. And the energy price cap really is straight out of Ed Miliband's pre-2015 election promise, although the Conservatives dispute that it's exactly the same. Really, there's not that much between them, even though the Conservatives condemned Miliband for outrageous Marxism at the time, as they would put it. So it did feel very much a speech that was reliant on some past Labour promises, and it also had a sort of more centrist tone, I think, than her speech last year, which was very much focused on Brexit and immigration. This felt a little bit different.
And like you say, not much on the EU, almost nothing on immigration. A more centrist sounding speech, perhaps a bit of red Toryism in there. And this personal touch, she talked about the British dream and for the first time told us about her grandmother who was a domestic servant and how proud she would be of her grandchildren. I think she said three professors and a prime minister. What's she trying to get across with that kind of personal side to her?
I think she feels very uncomfortable talking about herself, but one thing that was that was obvious, as you say, is that she was trying to drop in a few personal anecdotes about her background. There was another bit about how the NHS diagnosed her with diabetes and how she was very grateful to them for that. And she was trying to display a little bit more of herself because she has developed this characterisation of being a bit robotic, a Maybot. So our sketchwriter John Crace named her, and that name stuck. So she was trying to show that she's human. Why she carries on when she gets a lot of criticism? She said she's driven by trying to tackle injustices in society. So I think she's trying to show that she does have a personal life.
And I suppose one big consolation prize for Theresa May after a difficult speech is that the Maybot surely wouldn't cough like that. Rowena, thank you very much. Well, earlier in the week, I met up with the Education Secretary, Justine Greening, whose majority in Putney, one of the youngest constituencies in the country, was dramatically cut in the election. I asked her how the Tories could reach back out to young voters.
We've got to do positive politics. We've got to realise that negative party politics is a total turn-off to them. And we've got to realise that actually it's not enough to sort of say why we feel that Labour's getting it wrong, which we do. We've got to set out our agenda for young people and say how when we take their priorities and make them ours, what that practically is going to mean in their lives day to day. So I set out at conference some of the work that we're going to do to ease the burden on graduates, you know, but there's more to come. And I think we need to have a much broader strategy as a party to explain to anyone under 40, frankly, about why voting for us is going to directly improve their lives. And we've got to connect with their values and realise that there's a post-Brexit Britain that's out there in the world but strong at home. But it's got to be the kind of place that they feel is one that they are comfortable living in.
And just tell me what you think happened in Putney that your majority went down.
I think that I was in a part of the country where a lot of people voted to stay in the EU. I think a lot of young voters, although we had a 70% turnout, so they were already voting, and I'm pleased that a lot of them did vote for me. But I think there were still a lot of new voters that came into the election. And I have to say, when I was out on the doorstep telling people that it was really, really close, a lot of people asked me what my majority is, and I said 10k, and they laughed at me and said, you'll be fine. So I don't know whether there was a little bit of people feeling like they could send a message without thinking it might have a consequence. Of course, around the country, in many cases it really did, but I was really proud and delighted to get re-elected. So I'll keep doing my best for a constituency which actually is the youngest demographic profile of any constituency alongside Battersea in the country. So I am the Conservative MP representing the youngest group of the electorate in the country.
Fantastic. Justine Greening, thank you very much. Well, the central focus of much of this conference, much against the wishes of the leadership, was the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. He was accused of disloyalty after a newspaper interview that was seen as him laying down red lines on Brexit. But when it came to his speech, he cheered on the Prime Minister.
She won more votes than any party leader and took this party to its highest share of the vote in any election in the last 25 years. And the whole country owes her a debt for her steadfastness in taking Britain forward, as she will, to a great Brexit deal based on that Florence speech, on whose every syllable, I can tell you, the whole cabinet is united.
Okay, so I'm now joined by Antoinette Sambat, who is the MP for Eddisbury in Cheshire in the northwest. How's the week gone?
Well, I think it's very much a concentrating with getting on with the job week. There's been a lot of fluff and flunder around debates between Boris Johnson and Theresa May, but for the rest of us who are working MPs, we're actually concentrating on policy, and I think there's been quite a lot of excitement at the fringes, actually.
About policy, but just before we move on to it, I mean, you mentioned Boris Johnson and Theresa May. Is it a bit of a frustration for you that he has dominated the headlines?
For me personally, it is, yes, because I think we've got some fantastic policy initiatives that have been announced this week, and I'm not sure that they've made that into the newspapers. And I think it takes away some of the attention from what we're actually delivering and that fantastic record that we have. I've got 5,000 apprenticeships that have taken place in my constituency since 2010. We've got that really low rate of unemployment at 1.4%, and I think those messages are lost.
There was quite a lot of excitement in Brighton last week about the Labour Party, which is in a buoyant mood. How do you respond to that big surge in support for Corbyn?
Well, a lot of people don't understand what radical socialist policies mean. And of course, there was a split in the voting patterns and how that turned out. And I think, you know, we really need to go out and make the case. I was at a festival this summer. There was a beautiful days in Devon. And it had a rebel tent where they were discussing political issues, and the levellers who'd organised it encouraged people to get involved in politics. And I think that's right. I think people should. And I think we should be making the case to say we are the people that believe in individual liberty and people being able to live their lifestyle as they would like, but with that safety net, that safety net for those that need it.
I'm now with Mims Davies, who is the MP for Eastleigh and has been since 2015. You've talked before about the idea that some of the newer MPs perhaps feel differently to some of the ones who've been around for a bit longer.
I don't think we feel differently. I think we are different. And it's great to have the opportunity to tell our story, actually. So I think a lot of us come from much more varied and interesting and not typically Tory backgrounds, which I've been banging on for some time. We all have our own reasons for being here. Perhaps our backgrounds in terms of employment has brought this way. So we've got nurses and doctors and people with, you know, not historically on our benches from the 2015 intake. I was caring for my elderly parents before I came in. I was a councillor, and we're on the Conservative Women's Organisation stand here at the party conference. I was a regional chair there. 84 different constituencies we covered, but barely any women in the senior parts of the party. So I made sure that when I got onto the green benches that I was able to support women coming through, whether it's as councillors or any part of public life in this party, and making sure that we look and sound different, and being difficult women, absolutely, once we got through the door in Westminster.
And, you know, you say we're on this stand. One of the criticisms of the conference has been that a lot of the panels have been all male, that it feels a bit blokey. I mean, very much excitement about Jacob Rees-Mogg, who you might say doesn't have the most feminised of opinions. Are you worried about the direction of the party?
So the Mogg sits behind me in the chamber. So you've got the Mims and the Mogg. So, we are completely different in terms of our looks and our style, but actually get on very well. And I think this could be a very blokey conference, actually. There's a lot of young activists who are young guys, and that's great. But some of the key issues that we are talking about and connecting with as a party has had a smack on the nose, let's admit it, is about connecting to young people and about their issues. So, yeah, we need to make sure as a party, outwardly, people see us less blokey. There are a lot of really good women on our team, and, you know, we are the party with the second female Prime Minister. We have got a female, of course, at the head of the Home Office in Amber. And actually, we've got some great women who are doing a lot of work across the party. Many of the 2015ers, all of us are doing PPS work, so we're working with Secretaries of State or Ministers of State on bills, actually seeing how it works to be in government. And so I certainly think Theresa has made sure as Prime Minister that we are being utilised and we're learning our craft. So I don't think long term we'll look like the blokey party.
Mims Davies and Antoinette Sambatch there. So that's it. We are at the end of four more days in Manchester with the Conservatives. I'm now joined by Guardian columnist Matthew D'Ancona, our own sketch writer John Crace, and The Telegraph senior political correspondent Kate McCann to look back on it all. Matthew, has this been a good or a bad week for the Conservative Party?
Well, good in the sense that it was a stay of execution, I think, is about as much as I can muster. It sort of reminds me of death row, really, you know, when the governor's call comes through and the lethal injection is not actually applied. Obviously, the mood is one of mild uplift, but that's about it. No, it hasn't been a successful conference because it's been the Boris Johnson show with, supporting acts, including the Prime Minister. And I think that's not exactly what was planned by party managers.
Boris Johnson, Kate, who says he's totally innocent. He's totally behind the Prime Minister. He is the lion that has roared. Do you think the Prime Minister will be unbelievably frustrated with his performance over the last couple of weeks?
I think if she's not, her colleagues certainly will be, because this morning the Today programme interview, which was meant to be teeing up her big speech, was for at least the first 5 minutes only about Boris Johnson. Of course, he's made some remarks yesterday at Fringe which were pretty unpalatable, and he's even got colleagues in the party this morning calling for him to be sacked. I mean, that's really not what she wants on the morning of a speech which is supposed to reset the party and send them off in the direction looking at what they can do for the wider country in terms of policy and not in terms of fighting and infighting in Boris Johnson's potential leadership campaign.
Yeah, I mean, it has been quite a week. Boris has made a couple of big interventions on Brexit, said that actually there's nothing to see here, and then just popped out for a run with the editor of The Sun, trying not to draw attention to himself. John, you've watched it all from the hall. Talk us through what you've made of the different Tory characters this week.
Well, I mean, we have to start with Boris, as everybody else has, because he has been the dominant force of the conference, whether by his absence or by his presence. And it's, I mean, curious, the conference hall has been near half full for most speeches, even for the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, yesterday morning. There were a vast number of seats that were sort of unfilled. But come Boris, they were queuing out the door. There is no doubting that the Tory party kind of hardcore who come to the conference still love him. And it was amazing after the speech. I mean, I don't know whether the woman sitting next to me knew that I was a journalist from The Guardian or not. She turned around to me and with no sense of irony said, "You're not much of a team player." And I said, "And Boris is?" And she just sort of didn't get it. For, you know, as far as she was concerned, Boris was a star act and he had performed for them. Even though to me it felt like he'd just been playing some of his greatest hits, really. There was nothing kind of new. It was just a sort of few kind of Christmas cracker gags, really. But they love it and he delivers them very well.
Yeah, and he did suggest that we should put Jeremy Corbyn in a rocket and send him to space, which has obviously made the odd headline this morning. Now, the hall has not been that full, Kate, but there have been queues, as we heard, for Boris, but also for another man, Jacob Rees-Mogg. What's going on with this Moggmentum?
I think Jacob Rees-Mogg represents everything that the rest of the Conservative Party at the minute is failing to do, which is something a bit different, excitement. You know, you're right, Jacob Rees-Mogg packed out every venue that he went to this conference, and yet, you know, this is a bloke who dresses in a three-piece suit. You know, he's got a child called Sixtus, which is a great name, but an unusual name. And he does that because he's not actually afraid of what he is. He knows what he's about and he's authentic. And whether you like him or not, that's what he is. And that's actually what people are after most of the time, which I think is why people like Boris Johnson. I hate to go back to Boris. What I would say about Boris, though, John, is I wonder whether it's a little bit like watching a car crash happen and that people will still go and they'll queue to see him speak. But there is a feeling around conference, certainly among senior members of the government, that actually he's stepped over that line now and Boris is kind of treading in difficult territory, and whether he can come back from that or not. But Jacob, I mean, I don't think he's going to be the next leader of the party, but he's certainly something different. He's offering the Conservatives a chance to look at someone who's enthusiastic, knows what they're about, and isn't afraid to say it.
Well, in the Conservative Party, MPs have a say on who gets on the ballot for leadership, and most MPs I've talked to have suggested they would keep Jacob off that ballot. If they didn't, it does feel as if the members would vote for him, and this is a man who may be proud of who he is, but this is a man who boasts about never having changed a nappy despite having six children and has some really questionable views about issues like abortion. Matthew, the Tories didn't do very well with young people in the election. Is Jacob Rees-Mogg really the answer?
I would say he's not. If he's the answer, the question's the wrong one. And I think there's a danger which Jacob Rees-Mogg absolutely personifies, which is that politics just becomes a branch of entertainment. And that we again have this endless search for characters. And of course people queue up to see him because he talks about Magna Carta instead of childcare. You know, he talks about Agincourt instead of the NHS. I mean, I suppose it's a nice respite from talking about serious stuff, but it's not how you choose a leader to become a prime minister. The person I've been impressed by at this conference, who is still technically not in the running, is Ruth Davidson, who I think has been a fantastic antidote to some of the dryness and the kind of the sense of antiquity of this party. Mm-hmm. But she's not eligible. She's an MSP. She's not an MP. She says she's not running for the job. I know there have been delegations of people going to see her in private at this conference, saying, "Please, please, change your plan." And it is in the nature of politics that when the moment comes, you have to seize it, that her moment may not come again. So I think she's got some very difficult deciding to do.
And what does she represent in policy terms?
Well, she's an interesting mixture of social liberalism and economic conservatism, which is nothing new. But I think that she does it in a way that will appeal to voters who weren't necessarily traditional conservatives. You know, she's gay, she's a Christian, she's got a military background, she likes kickboxing, she drinks vodka, she eats Haribos. I mean, she's just a very unusual mixture of components. And I think that she really is the real deal. And I know that there are people at Labour who are concerned about her as someone who really could cause them problems.
And John, you've watched both of them at close quarters, Jacob and Ruth. You've already talked about Boris. Tell me what it is that creates such excitement around both those characters.
Well, Jacob Rees-Mogg is very much the old school, he's the safe place for the old Tories. On Monday morning, I went to a sort of meeting which was about how the Tory party could re-engage with the youth and create a sort of Tory momentum. There were 70 people there, almost all of whom were over 50, and they had a sort of mock vote for who should be the next leader, next chairman of the Tory party, and because they weren't electing a leader. And Jacob Rees-Mogg came out on top by a sort of landslide. The current party chairman, Patrick McLaughlin, got naught votes from the people there. I mean, that's sort of not a great sort of...
Who else was on the list?
Lord Ashcroft was on the list. I think Michael Gove was on the list too. He didn't score very highly either. Perhaps they have worries about his loyalty.
And the person who perhaps we haven't heard quite as much about this week, Kay, although of course we did have her speech today, is Theresa May. Now, she is clearly grappling with getting over that election result and trying to reach out to people who may have chosen Corbyn at the election. What do you think she wants to get across at this conference? What drives her in policy terms?
I think for Theresa May, this conference was always about trying to focus her party beyond Brexit and beyond the election, and that was always going to be really difficult because her speech came at the end of a conference where everybody has spent the whole time wondering if Boris is going to try and go for leadership and talking about his Brexit red lines, which is terrible in many ways. She should have spoken at the start of the conference and tried to set the tone from there. But I think going forward she wants to talk about things that we heard in the speech today, so you know, council housing, energy prices, things that she wants to reset the party back to where she was when she stood on the steps of Downing Street, because actually that message appealed to quite a lot of people across the political spectrum who are feeling the pinch. The problem she's now got is the problem, I come back to what I said at the start, she has a party that are deeply divided on the biggest issue of the day that will constantly keep coming back, Brexit. And I haven't seen anything at this conference to suggest that she's managed to pull that round and pull them together.
And Matthew, we've taken a while to get round to it, but it is the biggest issue of the day, Brexit. How is the Tory party managing with this divide right now?
Well, it's still labouring under the delusion that the divide that matters is within its ranks rather than between Britain and the other 27 EU nations. I mean, the worrying thing is that the country is governed by a party that seems to think that if it it will decide a Brexit line and that will be the deal. We're way past that point. What matters is that there's an agreed line which we then try and get the other 27 to sign up to. So this notion that, you know, the minutiae of the differences between Philip Hammond and Boris Johnson are what will dictate Britain's fate in the European sphere in the future is ridiculous. And I think that it's one of the ways in which the Tory party is starting to behave more like an opposition than a governing party, which I would say is the biggest problem it's evinced this week.
My thanks to Matthew D'Ancona, Kate McCann and John Crace. Now before we go this week, another party conference has been and gone. UKIP assembled its depleted forces in Torquay at the weekend. Our own Peter Walker made the journey to Devon to discover a new leader who few of us had ever heard of.
I'm in a very noisy conference hall in Torquay on what is known as the English Riviera, where UKIP are holding their annual conference. And this is not just any conference. This is a conference where they're going to be choosing a new leader. In fact, their fourth leader within a year. There's seven people going for the job, and it's such a close race that six of them could potentially win. The worry for more moderate UKIP members is a woman called Anne-Marie Waters, who is very vehemently anti-Islam and has some notable links to the far right, could be the one who wins in a very, very tight race. And more than that, whoever wins, basically, this is a party in search of a new purpose. The Brexit referendum has been won, and while there's still doubts within UKIP in particular about how the Brexit process will play out, this is a party which now has to decide what is its new purpose. I'm joined by Helen, who is from Young Independents, which is a UKIP youth wing. It's fair to say that most of the people in the hall are slightly older than you. Do you think UKIP has got a future as a party attracting younger people?
Yeah, I think it definitely has. And what we found, actually, is there are quite a lot of young people who feel like they don't fit into parties like the Tories and Labour. They feel quite patriotic. They're very concerned about democracy and sovereignty. And I think, really, there was a real energy about the Brexit campaign that attracted young voters from both sides, definitely. But I think the patriotism that's felt among youngsters is something that we haven't seen for a long time, and UKIP is a place that a lot of people who previously wouldn't have been interested in politics have been attracted to.
I'm joined in the conference hall by Juliet, who's wearing a kind of mustard yellow beret, a yellow jumper, a purple kind of gilet, purple. These are very UKIP colours. You're obviously a big UKIP fan.
Yes, I joined UKIP shortly after the referendum party came about. I personally feel we've got to ensure that we do actually leave the EU, because that's what people voted for. And, okay, I'm biased on that way, but I find it quite incredible that before the referendum results came out, there were various people saying, oh, we must abide by the results, and now they're turning that on the head and saying, oh, no, that's not what we voted for. We voted to get away from the EU, to get away from the European Court of Justice, definitely. We don't want two different sets of law in this country.
Making his way down from upstairs, so it may take him some time. Please give an appropriately lengthy cheer and round of applause with 3,874 votes. And 29.9% of the vote share, the new leader of our party, Henry Bolton.
The leadership result when he came in was not so much a shock, but certainly what wasn't what some senior people in UKIP feared. They feared a victory for Anne-Marie Waters. Instead, their new leader is Henry Bolton, a former soldier and police officer and official with the UN and various other organisations, who's kind of a bit of an establishment insider, you might say. But he won, even though he's relatively little known within the party before the election race, because he basically promised to professionalise it and to put on a footing in which it can organise itself properly. UKIP still faces a lot of problems, not least what its future is in a post-Brexit world. But they've got someone at the top who can perhaps steady the ship. Whether he can do any more than that, he's perhaps not the most charismatic speaker I've ever seen, remains to be seen. But UKIP has certainly bought itself a bit of time.
I'd of course also like to thank all of you who voted for me and the others who are out there who can't be here today who voted for me. Thank you. I'd also like to thank those of you who didn't vote for me because you were probably trying to do me a favour. Today is not only a crucial day for our party, it is a critical day for our country. Ladies and gentlemen, Brexit is our core task. However, it is not the end of the line. When we leave the European Union, that is not the end of the story. We want to be responsible for our own destiny, not have it decided in a foreign capital.
Henry Bolton there, ending that report by Peter Walker. Well, that's all we have time for in Manchester as the removal men dismantle the scenery here at Tory Conference. My thanks to Mims Davies, Antoinette Sambatch, Justine Greening and my panel, Matthew D'Ancona, John Crace and Kate McCann. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anoushka Astana. Thanks for listening.